Hi, I'm Dwayne Bradley, and you might know me from Open Journal, Monday evenings at 6 p.m. Thanks for listening to KPFT Houston.
That is the percolating beat of Ray Lynch's Clouds Below Your Knees. That means it's 6 p.m. on a Wednesday, and time for So What's Your Story. We're the only program originating in Houston devoted entirely to stories and the art of telling them, here on KPFT 90.1 FM, Houston's community radio. Well, I'm your host today, Eric Heen, backed up by the most talented team on radio. And here on So What's Your Story, we feature guests every week who will take us on magical journeys through their stories. Our program, So What's Your Story, has been on the air since 2008. That's 15 years. Over that time, we've brought over 500 storytellers, folks just like you, ordinary people with extraordinary stories to tell. And we're in a major KPFT fund drive. So to help keep our program going, along with all the great programming on KPFT, please consider donating. Call 713-526-5738, which is also 713-JAM-KPFT, or you can go to kpft.org. And when you call or go online, please designate So What's Your Story as the show you support. And now we'd like to hear from Dr. Elizabeth Hilborn. Dr. Hilborn is a veterinarian and honeybee specialist who's also worked as a disease detective with the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. When her own North Carolina farm was contaminated from toxic chemicals, Dr. Hilborn set out to uncover the cause of the damage and help her rural community recover. She chronicled this story in a new memoir called Restoring Eden. Dr. Hilborn, great to have you here on So What's Your Story?
Thank you so much for having me this morning. It's very nice to be here.
Dr. Hilborn, I'm about halfway through your book right now, and it's a fascinating story. So I wonder if you could just give us the whole story from the beginning.
I wrote Restoring Eden because I had a very unusual incident happen to me. In 2017, I was studying to start my first clinical veterinary practice as a honeybee veterinarian. And in March of 2017, I'd been out in my orchard taking pictures of all the amazing animals working the flowers. And so many of these were new to me. Most of my orchard is pollinated by native bees. So I was taking pictures of big fuzzy bumblebees and little tiny bees, wasps, flies. It was amazing. And I'd bring them in and show them to my husband. Within weeks, we had a flood. And I thought nothing of it. We live near a big river, totally normal. But after this flood, I went down in the floodplain to do some work on trees I'd planted along the river. And on my way back, I stopped by a section of, it's an old agricultural drainage ditch built early in the 20th century. And I stopped by the wetland because it's one of my favorite places to watch wildlife in our community. There are no fish there, so amphibians love it. It's always full of tadpoles. Insects love it because they can rest near the water and not be eaten by a fish. So it's very attractive to the small wildlife. And I stopped by that afternoon in early May, and what I saw shocked me. The water was golden brown, and it was covered by a thin gray scum. And I saw nothing moving in the water. It was very shocking. So I ran up the hill, got my husband, and I had trouble explaining what I'd seen because I'd never seen anything like it. But I didn't really trust my eyes because it was so bizarre. And I asked him to come look at it with me the next day to say, like, can you verify what I'm seeing? There's really nothing in this center of life in our community. It's dead. That's crazy. So the next day he did, and he verified what I saw, and we were trying to figure it out. I reached out to my neighbors. They had no idea. I had the presence of mind that day to collect water samples and put them aside. I called the farmer who farmed upstream of us and said, hey, I heard you out working before the flood. Did you do anything different? This is what I'm seeing. And he said, no, I just, as normal, just burned the vegetation down with Roundup, waited. Then I planted corn seed, waited. Then I injected nitrogen as fertilizer. Now, I know, because my training, I know that there are multiple toxins we use in our lives that at high concentrations can be very toxic to wildlife. And I do know that Roundup is very toxic to water creatures. So I was worried about the amphibians from Roundup, but he'd applied it so long before the flood. So I wasn't worried about the Roundup because my understanding was it stays where it's sprayed. And he didn't spray the wetland. He sprayed his fields. So when the week started, I started reaching out to agricultural experts, ecologists, insect specialists, pesticide experts, asking everyone, have you ever heard of such a thing? Mm-hmm. And I over and over heard, I've never heard of such a thing. One insect specialist told me, oh, you had a flood. Maybe all the animals washed away. And I didn't laugh at him, but I thought, wow, that is so ignorant, because we lived here well over a decade. I knew the cycles of the land really well. And I know that when we have heavy rain or a flood, and that ditch fills and becomes a wetland for weeks or months, that it brings life to the floodplain. All of the frogs rush out and take the opportunity to breed. We have so many dragonflies, and it's just like a center of life. So for a flood to erase life was, I felt like I was in, it was unexpected, unknown territory.
Right.
So I am very community-minded and am friendly with my neighbors, and one in particular, Bill. We share a love of gardening and growing fruit. I've been growing fruit for 30 years, and it was really the kind of the cornerstone of our life at the farm. So Bill came over to visit and brought me some seeds, and I was showing him a new kind of cucumber I was trying. And we were talking about the heavy rain that we just had and then the flood that preceded it. And he mentioned that our farming neighbor's tractor had been submerged. So I called him back and I said, hey, I am so sorry to hear about your tractor, Robert. This is really bad news. Can it be saved? I mean, tractors are so expensive. It was shocking to hear that. He said it was totaled. But I thought, you know, if it was underwater, could there have been any containers of chemicals near the tractor? And he said, nope, just the tractor. I said, well, did you have a spray tank on it? Nope. What was on it? Just the corn seed hopper with about 25 to 50 pounds of corn seed in it. I wasn't done planting. And I thought, well, that doesn't help. But I went back to the water and I thought, was it diesel fuel from the tractor? But there was no sheen of hydrocarbons. I'd never seen that. So I just felt like it was another dead end. And then I happened to read an article by Elizabeth Reut in Audubon magazine about a researcher who studies insect-eating birds in Canada, Christy Morrissey, and she was studying the birds to try to understand, did the decline of insects due to pesticide use in that agricultural region, how did that impact the birds' lives and their reproduction? So I reached out to Christy because by that time, at the farm, it wasn't just the wetland. By that time, within weeks of finding the wetland, all the moths disappeared from our porch light. We didn't even have gnats. We could have left the light on all night long, and there was nothing around it. It was eerie. I'd never seen anything like that. Our bats had left the evening skies. The chimney swifts had left the daytime skies. The dragonflies had disappeared. The flying insects in the air were gone. I could walk through paths at the farm. Nothing moved. It was eerie. It was like I was on another planet. I live in a rural area, and I'm so used to being surrounded by life and seeing that life. Our amphibians, we have toads hang out in the wash stall at the barn. They were gone. The birds were thinning out. They abandoned their nests. I checked my bluebird boxes. Same thing. The adults were all gone. So I was out there with my phone trying to document all this. And it was awful. First of all, I've never had anything like this happen to me where I'm immersed in the middle of an event. When I've investigated outbreak investigations, I do it for a job, and then I can remove myself from it. But in this one, it was happening to me. I was in the middle of this event, and I don't like that feeling because I didn't know what was happening, and I was so frightened. I think about animals and their role in the world. We tend to separate ourselves from the animals. But our physiology, we share a lot of attributes, and animals can be wonderful sentinels for human health risk.
Yeah, like the canaries in the coal mine.
Here we are with everything dying around us. And I'm like, wow, what about the dogs? What about the livestock? What about us?
Yes.
It was very scary. So I did hear back from Christy Morrissey, the researcher in the plains of Saskatchewan, and she told me that there are relatively new group of pesticides that have been used over the last 20 years or so, but they're used to coat crop seed. Mm-hmm. So they're not applied by the farmer. The farmer didn't tell me he applied them. But when I called him back with this new information, I said, did you use coated seed? Mm-hmm. And he said, oh, yeah, that green goo was all over the seed hopper. It was really hard for us to get it off.
Yeah.
And I realized maybe those seeds were the clue. The insecticide on his corn seed, they're very water soluble. They're very potent. And that was always like a real question for me was, how can 25 to 50 pounds of seed contaminate so much area? Mm-hmm. Like that made no sense to me. There were millions of gallons of water flowing through during that flood. And then I ran across Erin Hodgson at Iowa State, and she did the math for me. It was very helpful. One corn seed has enough insecticide on it to kill 80,000 honeybees.
One kernel?
And one kernel. And an acre of corn starts with 30,000 seeds.
Whoa.
Yeah, I sat down when I read that. So I learned that the seed coating is very water soluble. So when the seed is planted, even if there's no tractor accident, heavy rains or flooding can move the neonic away from the seed into the ditches beside the field. It can flow off into wetlands, streams, rivers, and it can be diluted, but when it's at a high enough concentration, it's lethal to the aquatic insects. It can kill amphibians. And I learned, because I kept initially, as we were in the process of losing our insects, I watched them almost disappear in the dry spells, the dry weeks. And then we'd get a little rain and I'd see a butterfly and I'd be all excited, like, oh, maybe they're coming back. And that would get dry again. Then they'd all go away until finally it didn't matter if it rained or not. They were all gone. Mm. But my thought was, oh, they were drinking from the wetland. It was the only safe water to drink from. Certainly the river was there, but there are the fish in the river, there are rapids and little waves, and it's riskier for a small animal to try to get a drink from fast moving water like that. So the wetland was the preferred choice of water. I put out livestock troughs on our uplands and filled them with water from the tap, because once I thought about the wetland being a source of poison for all the animals, I tried to give them an alternative. Wow. I put rocks and branches that I've stuck to sit on while they drank. But you know, how do you train a whole population of wildlife? Hey, here's the safe water. Mm. It was awful.
Wow.
So anyway, I once I understood what might be in the water, the farmer helped me. I said, look, it might be that coating. Do you have a label from your bag of seed? And he provided it to me, and I found the list of pesticides used on the coating. It was a neonic, clothianidin, and very persistent. Can have a half-life over 3 years. Half-life meaning it takes that much time for it to break down to half the concentration right. of when it started. So very persistent. And some fungicides as well. I was able to get my water samples tested once I had a list for the chemist to go by. And sure enough, clothianidin was recovered from the water, as well as some other surprises with the glyphosate. It was quite the journey, Eric.
Yeah, from reading the book, it's amazing how many hoops you had to jump through just to get this water tested. I mean, you would think that, well, there's some government agency can just test the water, see what's going on here. But you went through all kinds of different avenues and you're hitting dead ends everywhere.
Yeah, so that was a surprise to me too, because I work in health. And there is a very strong framework. If I had had dead livestock, or if I had been keeping bees at the time and had piles of bee bodies, the pesticide experts may have gathered that evidence and helped me.
Right.
And I say may because when I reached out to them, they asked me, well, was there a deliberate misuse of a pesticide? And I was like, no, I don't think so. I mean, I don't know. But of course, resources are limited at any government agency. And runoff from normal fields is not regulated. There's an exemption for agricultural runoff in the Safe Drinking Water Act. So right. he couldn't use his resources to chase down a bunch of dead wildlife. When I was reaching out to the wildlife specialists, I told a biologist my story. And he said, oh yeah, that happens all the time. And I was like, what? He said, yeah, either people don't notice it, or it's not as dramatic. Mm-hmm. And I was trying to figure out, why did I notice this? Because the farmer had been farming for a few years before this happened, and he was using coated seed. Why didn't it happen another year? Mm-hmm. My only thought was it reached a threshold maybe, and having the wetlands so contaminated was a continuing source of exposure for the animals. But also, I went down there that spring. I don't always go to the wetland every year. We hear the frog song every year. And I had noticed it change, but I also knew the farmer had started farming. And I think I kind of didn't want to pay attention to that. Because it's not our land, it's our neighbor's land. And this year in 2017, I looked at it and the water was dead. And so I think it's a couple things. I think I had greater awareness because I was looking for the life in the wetland, and there was higher concentration of contaminants into the water, so much so that it affected the uplands. Because I hadn't noticed a decrease in yield in my gardens and orchard until 2017. And then the following years, we had no apples, no pears, no blueberries. All the pollinators were gone from our area. And for many years, I'd see like bumblebees coming into our area to make a nest. And I'd planted so many pollinator plants, clean ones, ones that didn't have neonics in them. And I knew this before this incident, that many nurseries use systemic insecticides like neonics.
Oh, yeah.
And when insects feed on our pollinator plants that we buy, if they're contaminated, the insect can become poisoned from the nectar and the pollen, because the insecticide goes through all parts of the plant. So I had put out clean pollinator plants, so it would attract bumblebees in the spring, but they could never get their families started. Like, they didn't last. So we're just starting to recover, but we haven't recovered yet, 6 years later.
And you reached out to the company itself, I recall, from the book. The seed company, correct?
Seed distributors. So I don't really know the company that made the seed. What I had was a brand of the seed. And my understanding is the company can make seed and it's sold under multiple brands with multiple kinds of seed coating mixtures. But what I did learn was over 90% of corn crops in the US right now use coated corn seed. And coated seed is also used in cotton and soy and canola and wheat. And John Tooker from Pennsylvania State University, I believe, estimated that an area the size of Texas in the United States is planted in coated seed every year. And the seed, when it's planted, creates dust that can move out for 100 meters or so, can blow in the wind, and the dust can settle on neighboring plants, and then they take it up and become poisonous to pollinators, can flow off into surrounding water. When you're looking for it, it's common to find neonics in water in the United States now. All over the country, it's found in drinking water, surface water, and it can go down into well water. So to get back to your point about trying to find analysis, it was really hard. None of our state agencies, none of our county agencies that do drinking water testing, nobody tests for these chemicals. They're different than the older chemicals in that they're water soluble. And I had to start looking nationally. And I finally found a accredited laboratory that tests for agricultural pesticides by looking at someone else's research paper. They just happened to mention that they use them for their samples, because I was striking out in my search. All the environmental laboratories I contacted said, no, we don't test for that. So when I contacted the accredited laboratory, they said, you know, this is pretty common. It's, and we're at the point where we're having trouble finding uncontaminated water to use as controls. And that really scared me.
Wow, that is scary. And you say that it's hard to find seeds that are not coated with these chemicals?
Corn seed in particular is the most commonly coated. So you almost have to reach out and look to sources of organic corn seed or corn seed that is grown using the methods but not certified organic. So it does take some digging, but hopefully it's easier than my laboratory search.
Oh, yeah.
Most corn seed is coated.
But now you did finally have some success, I recall. There was a team came up there and they did find some results.
Yeah, so late in, it felt late in the process. It was only June. Time slowed during this event. A team came out and checked out the wetland and verified the insect situation was really unusual. One thing I didn't mention earlier, but I think is very important, is we live somewhat near this wetland. We've never had a problem with mosquitoes here. We can sit outside in the evenings and watch the sunsets without repellent on or anything. And this year in 2017, we had the worst mosquito infestation. And that was another thing that puzzled me, is how can they live in the water when all the other insects are gone? And I found out that someone had done a experiment showing that insects can build tolerance to neonics. So maybe that was it. What I did realize was all the animals living in healthy water had kept the mosquitoes in check, because of course there were mosquitoes laying eggs, but they were getting eaten. Their larvae was getting eaten by the dragonfly babies. And so we had this complex ecosystem in the water that, where everything was in balance, and it protected our health by controlling insects. But in 2017, all our helpers were gone. The bats were gone, the insect-eating birds. So when the group came down to look at the wetland, the mosquitoes were very, very prevalent. So I just wanted to mention that. But they took samples and they gave me a clue that was really helpful. Mm-hmm. And that was the plants near piles of wheat straw from a previous year where the flood had pushed wheat straw off my neighbor's land and it flowed into the wetland. All the plants around it looked burned. And I didn't really see that because they were burned closer to the wheat straw and less burned farther away. And the ones farther away were burned at the bottom, but not the top. And they saw that clearly and they said, look at this. And they took samples from there. They took samples far from there. And their water samples, they tested for all the pesticides that the state tests for, like all the old classes of pesticides, including DDT or pyrethroids. They were like, nope, everything's negative, it's fine. But they didn't test for the new pesticides that are the most commonly used pesticides in the world now. Neonics are the most commonly used insecticides. Glyphosate, the most commonly used pesticide overall and the most commonly used herbicide, they don't test for those chemicals.
Well, that's what's in Roundup, correct? The glyphosate?
It's glyphosate, thank you. Yeah, Roundup. So they said, oh, nothing here. But then I got my water samples tested at the laboratory that could test for those things, and they found the neonics in the water. And I also sent the wheat straw samples that appeared to be burning plants, and those were full of glyphosate years after they'd been sprayed.
Hmm.
And that was a real shock to me because I thought glyphosate broke down quickly. And apparently it does on bare soil. But if you spray vegetation with it, it only breaks down. My understanding is from reading the research reports, it only breaks down when the plant has fully decayed. So the wheat straw kept releasing glyphosate into the water.
Was the issue then both the glyphosate and this neonic coating on the seeds? Was it both?
Yes. So when you get out into the environment, you're always dealing with mixtures. Always, always, always. So we had the corn seed had the neonic insecticide, had three fungicides, and one of those is known to make neonics even more potent. We had nitrogen and we had glyphosate just from that one field upstream. But there are other contaminants that flow over ground, oil from our cars, tire dust. I mean, we live in a sea of contaminants because of all the things, products we use and things we do. But yeah, so I can't say this one thing killed that one thing. There were multiple contaminants from the cornfield.
So where did you go from there?
So my neighbors, I'd been in close contact with them throughout this process, close contact with the farmer, and they'd helped me so much. And they told me what was happening at their place. The farmer told me all that he was doing. He gave me the lot number on his seed, and I had promised them that I would tell them what had happened when I figured it out. My goal was once I knew and got those water results, I would tell them everything that I knew. I would just brain dump. And that was problematic because a lot of it was really technical, like saying the word glyphosate. I was talking with my neighbor and I happened to say the word and he said, "Oh, don't start with those chemical names now." And I was like, "Oh, I'm so sorry. This is my life now. Are these crazy, hard to pronounce chemical names? I don't mean to burden you with that." So I made up packets of written information and I made a meeting and met with my neighbors and walked them through what I'd found. And boy, that was tough, Eric. That was really tough to tell people that something that happened on their land affected me and that it was affecting them. I mean, they were having problems in their orchard and garden.
And this is their livelihood. That's how they make a living. I could see how that must have been a sticky situation. Well, we're going to take a little break from our program now for station identification and to make a few announcements. You're listening to So What's Your Story on KPFT 90.1 FM, Houston's Community Radio. Our show is sponsored by the Houston Storytellers Guild. The Guild holds various storytelling events throughout the year, like workshops and monthly story swaps. You can find out more about the Guild by going to houstonstorytellers.org. And while you're on that same website, you can check out our program by clicking on So What's Your Story? There you will find archives dating all the way back to 2008. We're also on Facebook. Just go to the So What's Your Story page on Facebook to keep up with all the latest happenings on our program there. And don't forget our friends at the Moth Storytelling Organization. The Moth holds monthly story slams the second Tuesday of every month down at the Warehouse Live on Emanuel Street. The next slam will be November 14th. And I'd like to remind you we are in the midst of our KPFT Fun Drive. So please call 713-526-5738 with your donation, or you can go to kpft.org to support public radio. And when you donate, you can designate our show, So What's Your Story, to help us along our way. And now we're going to get back to our guest, Dr. Elizabeth Hilborn. Yeah, I'm about halfway through the book, and so I don't know how it turns out, but I'm to the point where you're even considering legal action against them.
Well, yeah, so not legal action. I wanted to know, like, is it legal for all of our animals to just be killed and stay dead? Like, is it legal to do that? Because what happened was, after I presented the evidence to them, they told me they'd be planting more corn down there. And I knew that this stuff is cumulative, like, because the half-life is so long, the concentrations in the wetland would continue to build every time a corn crop using that active ingredient was sown. Because when it rains, because it's water soluble, it goes out into the soil and then the ditches and then the wetland.
It wasn't just a one-time thing with the flooded tractor.
No.
Just planting the corn would have had the same effect?
Yes. In fact, my sweet neighbor had said, look, go on our land, look, gather what you samples, whatever you need to do. We need to figure this out. And I'd walked on a stream that drains his uplands where there was also corn planted. And in that stream, there was no gray scum. It was moving, but it was totally dead. When he talked about all the crawfish in the stream, there's normally water striders on little calm areas. There was nothing. I was turning over rocks. There was nothing alive in that stream.
Wow.
And I said to him, you didn't have a flood. This stream wasn't under a flood. This is the drainage from normal rainfall.
Mm-hmm.
And I walked way uphill of the farmer's cornfields and looked at a neighbor's pond. It looked totally normal. There were frogs, there were dragonflies, there were all kinds of insects, water striders, diving beetles. I was like, right, this is what normal looks like. Mm-hmm. And then I'd go back down into the farmed area, and it was hollowed out. So I knew at that time, when they told me they were going to do it again, I said, if you keep doing this, I don't have pollinators anymore. This has gutted my food production. We have these hordes of mosquitoes. We can't go outside and enjoy our land the way we used to.
Right.
So I consulted a lawyer and I said, what can we do? And he said, well, when it comes through the air, it's chemical trespass. When pesticides flow through water, you know, they're not regulated, but this is harming you. So let's ask them to cease and desist.
Mm-hmm.
And he sent a letter, please cease and desist this activity. And soon afterwards, I got a phone call from my neighbor and he said, so what are you going to do if we plant this again? I said, I'm going to be standing on my land in the next big rainfall, collecting water samples of the runoff from your food.
Sure.
And he said, okay, that's all I need to hear. And they stopped planting the treated seed. And I'm very grateful because, like I said, we haven't recovered totally, but we're starting to recover. So there's definitely hope. And Eric, I think this could have crushed me, this experience, if I had focused on what I'd lost. Because I'm a veterinarian, I love animals so much. And these were animals I had just started gearing up for my vet business. So pollinators in particular, I was learning of their amazing industry and diversity and their essential role in our world, not only to produce us food, but all the plants that depend on them to reproduce.
Right.
Trees and bushes and flowers, wild ones. So I learned as we slowly recovered to focus on everything alive, to focus on every positive development. And I think that's what got me through. Otherwise, it was really tough psychologically. But focusing on what is here and the beauty that's here really helped me.
Yeah, I'm from a farming background myself, and I know I've seen some bitter disputes between neighbors over such things. So I'm glad that there was some understanding. So they never planted the corn again?
They've not used the treated seed again, to the best of my knowledge.
Great.
Yeah. So my takeaway from this is we've moved from a system of agriculture. Before the early 90s, corn crops would receive insecticide about 30% of the time when they needed it, when there were pest insects present. Now we've moved to a model where insecticides are applied to the corn over 90% of the time, whether they're needed or not.
Mm-hmm.
And my work with the insects has shown me that this creates a cycle of dependence on pesticides because it kills all the good insects. Insecticides are not specific to pests. Insecticides kill insects. And yet we have this crew, this farming helping crew of beneficial insects like beetles and different kinds of bugs that when pest insects start increasing, I've seen it myself in my garden and orchard, the beneficial insect eating insects come in and take the pests down. Mm-hmm. So to take all the good guys out, there's no one other than us to fight pests. And by doing it chemically, it builds resistance.
Mm-hmm.
And we're starting to see resistance build to neonics. And
is there progress in this area, Dr. Hilborn? I mean, more organic measures being taken. Is there any progress here?
Well, absolutely. I think that from the farmer side, farmers are seeing their soils degrade. It kills the insects in the soil as well. So the quality of the soil degrades. So farmers are saying, hey, my resource, my soil is getting worse doing this. The pollinators, people notice the pollinators are going. They're in a deep dive. Many insects are in a deep dive. People notice the lack of butterflies. So many farmers, and especially young farmers entering the business, are choosing to farm organically or by regenerative methods and not use the coated seed, to use fewer pesticides, to use them just when they're needed, rather than trying to spray or use pesticides every single time with the coated seed.
Right.
So there's organic demand for food is growing. Organic production is growing. It's definitely a phenomenon.
I'd like to read this excerpt from your book. And I thought this was crazy. It said, okay, based upon reports of studies of multiple types of crops, it appears that discontinuing routine use of neonic-coated crop seed to protect wildlife, water, and soil will not cut crop yields. And farmers who use uncoated seed will pay less for that seed and reap higher profits per acre. So it seems like a no-brainer. It's doing more harm than good.
Yes, and I think that's true in general when the seeds are used every time a crop is sown. Certainly, some studies have shown the seeds are very useful on very wet years, early cold years when seeds are put in the ground. They can help protect the crop. There's still question about whether yields are really increased, but I'm not an agronomist. I'm just reading other people's work. So that's my understanding. But I definitely believe after this experience and all that I've read and delved into and all the agronomists I've spoken with, mm-hmm. that we do not need to be using them every time a crop is grown.
Mm-hmm.
And the business model that does that, that is we're being pushed towards resistance to these very powerful tools, these pesticides that can be used in small amounts and be so effective, over time, they will lose their effectiveness as resistance grows. So right. I feel like we're squandering a resource that I'm sure was millions or billions of dollars to develop. These should be stewarded and used in a judicious manner when they're needed, in my opinion. But I'm I don't make the rules. But yeah, people are definitely seeing benefits to not using them, because once you've wiped out all your beneficial insects, your farming helpers, if you've been using these for a long time and your land has no insects or few insects on it, it takes time for them to come back.
So where are you right now with your farm, Dr. Hilborn? Has it's been, what, 4 or 5 years now?
Yeah, six years. So
how far has it recovered?
Well, this year it comes and goes. Like, it's not linear. I thought it would kind of be a linear recovery, but it's not. Last year we had some apples. This year in my whole orchard I had 2 apples. We had some blueberries this year. And last year was good too, but that was the first year, 2022, that the blueberries came back. So it comes and goes. This was not a good bee year. We had very few bees this spring. And I thought it might have been our crazy weather, because we had warmth early and then it got cold. But when I drive outside this little community, a mile down the road, the apple trees are full of apples. I don't know how to interpret that. Is it the insecticide just keeps, you know, it's not, it's so persistent and animals are so sensitive to it.
Yes, it seems overwhelming. There's so many factors here, so many chemicals out there. How do you sort all this out? Plus, on top of that, you have political interests. You have commercial interests. I don't know how you do it.
Yeah, I don't try. I just, you know, I do live my life. I use disinfectants, pesticides, antibiotics only as a last resort. I don't routinely use these strong biocides unless I need them. Absolutely. If there are alternatives, I use the alternatives. I don't know if you remember antimicrobial soap. Many bacteria developed resistance to triclosan because we were using it all the time. So it's a biological principle. If you throw a biocide at the natural world constantly, it develops resistance. So I minimize my use of biocides. But other than that, you know, I can't control the world. I just try to control what I have control over and do my best. You know, I support local farmers who are using alternative methods. I buy organic food when I'm at a grocery store and I can't ask the farmer how they farm. Many people aren't certified organic because it costs money and a lot of record keeping to be. But a lot of local farmers here, we have a lot of specialty crops, so fruits and vegetables. People grow row crops here organically. I get to know my local farmers, and I support the ones who are using life-affirming methods. They're soil fertile. They're preserving their pollinators, and I give them my money.
Good. Yeah, I like how you're just trying to get to the truth of everything. So I recall years ago talking to a county agent. I was living up in Montana. He was talking about Roundup, and he's trying to convince me how safe Roundup was. He said it merely interferes with the enzymes in the plant. He says it's not like poison. And he said, you could almost drink it, he said. So that's the kind of misinformation you're up against.
Well, you know, this has been a journey with the Roundup. It started in the 70s because I certainly heard all those messages in TV commercials and promotional materials. And what we now understand is the important role of microbes in our health. Our gut microbes, our skin microbes, healthy microbes in our respiratory tracts, these all protect us. They work with our nervous system, with our immune system.
Right.
And what we now know is that glyphosate can alter microbes. It poisons microbes as well as plants.
What is your prognosis for the future here, Dr. Hilborn? Do you think, are we heading toward a more organic food production?
I am very, very hopeful that we are heading towards a way of producing food that will allow us to produce food far into the future for our children, our grandchildren. Right now, we're not focusing on the resources. That's my take home. We have to focus on the soil quality and preservation, focus on the pollinators and the helping insects, because if we destroy those basic things, we will lose our ability to produce food. In the Corn Belt of the Midwest, a recent paper showed we have destroyed the soil to the point where a third of the Corn Belt people are now planting in subsoil. The topsoil is all gone.
Right.
And that's the prairie. That was the deepest, some of the best agricultural land in the world.
The breadbasket.
So this is my take home, is we need to support our farmers. They are being pushed to the wall with low crop prices. They are being pushed to farm as many acres as possible, as quickly as possible. We're mining our soil. We're taking the fertility out of it. We're not using it as a resource in partnership where we're adding back, because many farmers don't have the financial cushion to take the time to add back. We need to support the people who are growing our food so that they can support the resource we need to move into the late 21st, the 22nd century with food production intact.
Right. And I really want to tell you, Dr. Hilborn, I admire your approach in this. You're not name calling. You're not throwing Molotov cocktails at people. You're engaging in discussion with your neighbors, with the government agencies and so forth. And I think that's what we need to address things like this.
Yeah, well, we're all in this together, right? And I can't think of anything more central to all of us needing and caring about than food production, feeding our children, having food we can afford that's healthy.
Right.
That's a passion of mine.
There's nothing more important.
So what I've learned is what I feel I can do is I can make choices with my pocketbook. I can support the farmers who are farming in a way to preserve preserve the resource. I can buy organic when I'm at the grocery store. I can choose what I buy in a very purposeful, thoughtful way. But anyone can support pollinators in the natural world by planting flowering plants free of these systemic insecticides. And people don't need acres and acres or a big yard. Pots of flowers, little sections of flowers near a sidewalk, anything where the animals can feed, because we really run into a lack of clean, healthy flowers for pollinators.
So that's something we can all do. Plant more flowers.
Yes.
Well, we're getting a little short on time here now, Dr. Hilborn. And I just want to reiterate, the name of your book is Restoring Eden. And it's available on Amazon.
Yes, it's available wherever books are sold.
And you also have a website.
Sure. It's ElizabethHilborn.com. And Hilborn is spelled with one L.
I appreciate you being our guest here on So What's Your Story? And I noticed from your book, you're kind of a philosopher too. So could you leave our listeners with some kind of final words of wisdom about this whole situation?
I just, food is a gift to us. And I just feel it's so precious, and it requires our thoughtful attention and our care. And I am so grateful for the plenty we have now. And I hope that we can come together to ensure that for our children and our grandchildren.
Great. Well, those are very good words to end this segment with, Dr. Hilborn. Thanks for being our guest, and good luck to you in your mission here and in all your endeavors.
Oh, thank you so much, Mr. Heen. It's been a pleasure to be here. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Well, that is our show for today, folks. I'd like to thank our guest, Dr. Elizabeth Hilborn, for her inspiring story. And I'd like to remind you one more time that KPFT is in the midst of a fund drive, and you can help support public radio by calling 713-526-5738, which is also 713-JAM-KPFT, or go to kpft.org and click on the donate button. With your support, you can help to ensure that KPFT will keep bringing you quality programming. This is Eric Heen, and along with the rest of the So What's Your Story team, we want you to always remember that it's never too late to live happily ever after.
Inch by inch, row by row, gonna make this garden grow. Gonna mulch it deep and low, gonna make it fertile ground. Inch by inch, row by row, please bless these seeds I sow. Please keep them safe below till the rains come tumbling down. Pulling weeds, picking stones, we are made of dreams and bones. Need a spot to call my own, for the time is close at hand. Grain for grain, sun and rain, find my way in nature's chain. Tune my body and my brain to the music of the land. Inch by inch, row by row, gonna make this garden.
This fall, Discovery Green and KPFT are teaming up to discover Houston's top bands. The city's live music lovers are invited to vote now through October the 18th for their favorite up-and-coming talent. Over 80 bands applied, and now just 20 remain. This is your chance to turn up and turn on Houston's vibrant music scene. The winning band will play the Discover Houston Music Showcase at Discovery Green on November 4th from 7 till 10 p.m. For more information and to cast your vote, visit discoverygreen.com/Discover Houston Music.
Hi, I'm Matt Harlan from right here in Houston, Texas. KPFT, a special radio station. When I moved here, put it on the dial, and I don't think I've ever taken it off. 15 or so years I've been around. At its essence, it's the community that helps all of us, musicians, music venues, everybody involved in the industry, talk to each other, promote each other, support each other. That's what Houston has always meant to me, and KPFT is pretty much the radio embodiment of what I think the Houston music community is. We would be lost without them. So hope you keep listening, donate, support. You'll hear us sometime soon.